Okay, thanks, George, and let me thank all organizers of this wonderful workshop. It's great to be here. When I was given the opportunity to participate in the workshop, usually I have sort of something in mind that I want to talk about, but then at that time it was way too early to tell what it shall be, so I intentionally chose a topic or a title that is more or less sort of encompassing any topic that has been sort of addressed in this workshop. Or maybe I'm specifying a little bit in the sense that I will try to give you sort of a survey of some works that we've been pursuing in the context of magnetism as it appears in these spin orbit d-orbital models, where there's strong interactions and possibly topology joining to give rise to interesting phenomena. And the intention is that given the workshop is will still hold on for a couple of weeks, we have a lot of chance to discuss in more detail what I'll be talking about. So let me start by thinking about correlated electron systems in general and what type of phenomena they give rise to, all of which we're interested in. So let me start with frustrated magnets. That is obvious. So when we enter the Mott phase, then the spin degree of freedom is the only one left, and it can give rise to all sorts of phenomena, and we'll be addressing a couple of these aspects later on. But then superconductivity, we heard by Fan about collective phenomena associated with this. Then, of course, spin orbit phenomena to the heart of it, for example, Z2 topological insulators, as they have been first discovered in Laurens Mohlenkamp's group in Würzburg, and quantum Hall effect as sort of, I think, the most established topologically non-trivial arena for condensed matter physicists. And I think in some way or the other, you all heard about all these different topics within this workshop. And one reason for that is that they all sort of link from one perspective that has become extremely fashionable in contemporary condensed matter physics. This is thinking about topology and how it allows us to classify and cross-connect different fields of established condensed matter physics. Sometimes it gives rise to new phenomena, but sometimes it also just allows us to make interesting connections between these different fields. Now, specifying to the LS Matter workshop here in Santa Barbara, of course, the center of it is the role of spin-orbit coupling and, in conjunction with correlations and topology, what type of physics it gives rise to. And thinking about how one could classify these different fields, I thought about the following three arenas. So the first one would be frustrated anisotropic magnetism. I think the punchline is fairly simple. If you have spin-orbit coupling in the band structure, then as you add interactions to the problem and map onto an effective spin model, generically you will get anisotropic spin exchange terms. And that has been the basis for all sorts of wonderful physics, such as the as one of the biggest highlights, the work by George and Gignat on possibly accomplishing the Kitaev model in such iridate compounds. And we'll hear a bit more as the talk progresses. Then this arena is sort of complemented by another direction that I would call interacting topological insulators. So what I mean by this, so as we heard in the discussion with Fan and Werner Hanke in the discussion section of the last talk, we heard already that the role of interactions within band structures that give rise to non-trivial topology can be fairly non-trivial. The obvious question is, can interactions destroy that phase? And the answer is obviously yes. But then there's more subtle questions to ask, such as, can actually interactions be vital to even giving rise to these phases? And we've seen a couple of scenarios in the last years where this actually exactly applies. So that's sort of the second regime, I would say. Here I'm talking about localized electrons where the spin degree freedom is dominant. Here I'm talking about bad insulators that can still be thought of as an itinerant version of electronic interacting systems, where still interactions can play an interesting role. And then, which I only got into lately, there's this third topic where itinerant electrons and localized electrons sort of conspire to give rise to new topological phases. And one, this is just a plot of samarium hexaboride. And I feel in all these three directions, actually the community has split a little bit, and also the methods employed differ very strongly. In the following minutes, I try to constrain my and your attention to the first field, where we talk about frustrated anisotropic magnetism, which is to say, for the major part of the talk, I'll just constrain ourselves to looking into effective spin models that originate from spin orbit interacting electron systems. Okay, so let me mention some recent collaborators of mine on this particular topic. Let me first mention my group in Würzburg with Vera Schnelz, a PhD student, Yasir Iqbal, a postdoc, and you might know Yasir from his works on the gapless spin liquids on the Kagome lattice, and Martin Greiter. And then when it comes to material-related physics, we are very grateful for the help that is given to us by José Valenti and Harald Jeschke, as well as Igor Masin. And then there had been other aspects of the work that center around Johannes Reuter, as well as Simon Trebst and Dima Abanin. And obviously, as you can see, a lot of these people have actually been at the conference either or at some other stage of that workshop. And Natasha is here. We worked with her on the one certain aspect on the iridates. There's Stefan Rachel, who has been here for a couple of weeks. Well, Tobias Meng has not been here, but this is also linking to a final topic that you will see later. He's currently a postdoc with Matthias Wolter in Dresden, and of course you all know Philipp Gegenwart.
Why last names?
I'm sorry?
Why last names?
Oh.
Not first.
I don't know. I wasn't even aware of that. Yeah. So maybe the inflationary use of certain first names. Well, no, there's one Simon, there's one Johannes. Igor. Yeah, no, you're right. I could have used, actually, you're right. The first names would be unique. Yeah, true. Okay, with this important comment, let's go on to the
last name. It's a pleasure for the people are not in the field.
That's one thing. The other thing is, of course, when you look for papers, you want to Google their last names, not their first names, right? So let me come to the outline. So the first thing I will talk about is basically just an allusion to the fundamental work that George did with his collaborators, the Heisenberg-Kitaev model, and what we have to say there. The second larger topic, and that is, of course, at the heart of what interesting physics might originate from this notion of frustrated magnetism and spin orbit correlated electron systems. The next one is I actually want to take a closer look to standard topological band structures and investigate the strong coupling limit of them, in particular the Kamen-Lee model and others. And the third topic, and I hope I have time to get there, is that I'm trying to connect one major research of mine, namely chiral-spin liquids, to the outset of what these spin orbit strongly correlated materials have to offer, in the sense as to how anisotropic spin interactions might be helpful in order to stabilize one of the, one of the most sought after topological quantum states of matter these days. Okay, so let's have a look. Well, these talks, when I want to communicate my results, usually, of course, I have to introduce the method, and that sometimes takes too long. So I will just introduce the method to you in sort of a black box fashion, knowing that I'll be here for another 2 weeks, and I'm very welcome to discuss with you any detail that you want to hear. I also want to announce that for a couple of months by now, we've been writing on an extensive review where we will put a source code in, where any student, I hope at least, any student can go, and within 10 days he should be able to run the code, work with the method, and get acquainted with it. So we're working on this review. So for the moment, let's just interpret the next 3-4 minutes as a teaser for the review. So when we want to approach the problem of frustrated magnetism, what type of method should we use? And let's first have a look at the problem in general. which I would call the scaling problem. So when we talk about some Hamiltonian that we derived microscopically in some strong coupling expansion or something, then we would be talking about a Hamiltonian whose energy scales are far higher than the characteristic temperature scales at which we would see phenomena coming up. So for example, so when this would be of the order of 10 to the 5 millikelvin, then magnetism, and by magnetism I mean fairly unfrustrated magnetism, would show up fairly quickly, maybe one order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude below the characteristic energy scales of the problem, because quantum fluctuations are always present, obviously. But then there's this notion of frustrated magnetism, where even way further down in temperature or analogously in energy scale, you would not be able to find a magnetic ordering phenomena. And that, of course, is suggesting already a methodological idea where you should be able to treat different scales and extrapolate to a low energy description of the magnetic problem. So that is what this slide is supposed to suggest. So what's the natural thing that any theorist would come to any theorist's minds in this context? That's, of course, randomization group. So the question I want to pose is, starting from some magnetic Hamiltonian of this kind, what type of randomization group can we formulate to eventually arrive at these interesting correlated states of matter that we find for low, low temperatures in these magnetically frustrated systems? And by now, the range of possible phases has extended enormously. For a long time in the 50s, 60s, 70s, people were majorly concerned with unconventional magnetic ordering. But then as Xiaogang Wen entered the stage, I think that was the critical step there. I mean, there were previous works, but I think Xiaogang is the main contributor there. Then people were thinking more about unconventional spin liquids and as to what type of quantum paramagnetic states of matter we can define, how we can classify them. And by now, with all this wealth of possible states, we need a randomization group approach that is ideally capable of treating all these different possible phases on a universal footing. That would be, of course, the ideal choice. So the angle at which we want to approach the problem is fermions. And for that, of course, we don't want to deal with any bosonic representation of spin, but we want to deal with a fermionic representation of spin. And that goes back to Abrikosov, back in the days where he would start to adopt RPA fermionic methods to magnetism. So you can just represent the spin operator by fermions and the Pauli matrix accordingly. And then now, as you try to transfer any spin Hamiltonian into fermionic language, you have to aware yourself of the fact that you have hugely enlarged the Hilbert space. Because if you want to map to the spin problem, then you have to enforce the single occupancy per site, which in many circumstances is very hard to treat. And mostly people would employ a mean field treatment of that by saying, well, the single occupancy constraint is obeyed globally, but we sort of forget about the local fluctuations that might still be allowed in the exact map. So then if we employ this mean field treatment for the time being, the Heisenberg model will just map to a strongly interacting fermionic model, where in a way strongly interacting means infinitely interacting, because we don't even have a band structure to begin with. We just get an interaction term, f dagger, f dagger, ff. And the question then is, how can that possibly be an interesting starting point for any sort of fermionic randomization group? And the bottom line there is that as soon as you think about perturbative schemes, of course you would immediately arrive at the conclusion that this is impossible to do, but you should aware yourself of the fact that there can be self-consistent resonations. And self-consistent resonations actually allow to go beyond perturbation theory, even though you have a diagrammatic formulation of your problem. And in essence, that is what spin FRG, I call it short spin FRG, Johannes Reuter, with whom I worked on this, prefers to call it the pseudofermion functional RG. This is where this kicks in. And the starting point will just be electrons that we assume to be in the Mott limit, where they just where the charge degree is frozen out. So we start with literal fermions that are local, as you can see from the Green's function. But we dress them, or we assign to them, a cutoff parameter, which is then subject to flow equations from where we hopefully arrive meaningful, effective two-particle vertices and single-particle vertex. So that's the single-particle Green's function. That's just our notation for the two-particle Green's function, or if you cut off the legs, that's then what you're left with is the two-particle vertex. And that is the low-energy theory that we then exploit to ask what type of magnetic ordering phenomena or disordering for phenomena might appear.
How crucial or how dangerous are these words mean fields in all the physics?
Yeah, so So this assumption recast in a so if you take Xiaogang Wen's approach from 92, then enforcing this mean field treatment of the single occupancy constraint means that you basically remove the temporal gauge fluctuations. You just remove all temporal gauge fluctuations. This, at least when it comes to magnetic order, throughout history hasn't proven to be very crucial. So like this mean field treatment of the single occupancy constraint is actually fairly controlled for most phases. There are exceptions. For example, a U1 Dirac spin liquid, where you manifestly want to have the full Lorentz symmetry, then this might be a problem. But that we should not worry about too much for the moment. There are other arguments which I intentionally try to avoid because I want to get to the heart of the physics here.
Are there no problems, for example, with something like local gauge invariance or something like that?
No. That's not an issue in this formulation. But the main issue is I have a strongly interacting fermionic model. I devise flow equations that in one way or the other relate to diagrammatic summations. How can I be sure that I'm not throwing away diagrams that turn out to be important? That's the crucial question, and that is, say, 80% what the review will be about. But for now, and if you allow, I intentionally tell you this as a black box and postpone further discussions about the methodological details to discussions in the workshop. So the pseudofermion RG, so what does it offer? So it offers a low energy two-particle description. So this is just the three frequencies of the two-particle vertex and two spatial indices. We formulate the Green's functions in real space and frequency space. And what we get is basically a flow of this two-particle vertex function from where we are allowed to infer possible magnetic orders. An example that I show you here is the magnetic order on the triangular lattice. So on the triangular lattice, we see that one set of couplings diverges as a function of the cutoff. This is the cutoff that goes from high energies to low energies. And what we see is that the system adopts a certain type of magnetic order. So then the next thing that we can ask is, what type of magnetic order is this? So we literally take the diverging vertices and get the susceptibility treatment and infer the magnetic susceptibility from the two-particle vertex. And that would be in the extended zone scheme, so we don't map anything back to the gamma point. This is literally how neutron experiments would look like. There's no backfolding. So that would be the magnetic ordering peaks, and they are exactly linked to 120 degree.
On one of your previous slides, you have this whole zoo of potential instabilities that you would like to go through. So actually, apart from the divergence in the magnetic susceptibility, which other susceptibilities can you actually treat with this method?
Yeah, we can treat no other susceptibilities, but we can treat, for example, the dimer response function.
So valence bond solids.
We can go for dimer response functions. When it comes to asking what type of spin liquid is it, then I think you need to take the final low energy description and then work with it further. There's no such notion like a divergence when you enter such a spin liquid. There might be in the gauge sector. Those are, again, details that still need to be addressed. The method is still in the process of becoming more mature as it concerns these different magnetically disordered states of matter. But when it comes to magnetic order, we are able to look at vector ordering. We are able to look for response functions of quadrupolar orders. Precisely for the reason that, of course, you know well, we look at spin-spin correlators. So all you can do there is either you get the full susceptibility of a vector order, or you get a response functions of a quadrupolar order.
But instead of starting from nothing and putting that interaction, could you do a mean field treatment of that and then adding also? Starting from that, you can follow the RG flow. Is it better? Have you tried to do this?
One can do that. But we prefer to leave the starting point of this flow equations as free as possible.
Because if you start from different answers, from different spin liquids, maybe from that you can understand the nature of the spin liquid?
Yeah, the point is, the first thing, the strongest statement I want to make sure is that we're not running into any magnetic order. So if I add terms that are sort of maybe not justified macroscopically, that push me into a spin liquid domain from the start, I wouldn't like that so much, because the zeroth order thing is I want to avoid magnetic order of any kind. I want to see that this happens. And then when that happens, I want to talk about more about what this versus is. I knew this is happening, but Kang.
Yeah, thanks. So this quadrupolar order for spin 1/2 system, so you really mean Bondi dynamics?
That's essentially what I mean.
I see.
Whatever order parameter is not represented by a single spin, but by two spins. Since we can only look at spin-spin objects,
yeah,
we can only get the correlator for vector order, but we can get the response functions for spin-spin order objects.
Yeah.
In the same logic as I told Wolfram Drenig, that we can look at dimer response functions, but not at dimer correlation functions. Okay? But Natasha had a question.
I just want to ask you, if you have several competing instabilities,
yeah,
then how you basically distinguish between them? What is the quantitative approach to this?
The quantitative approach is, when there are actual instabilities in the flow, we just pick the one that is dominant, that starts to diverge at a higher energy scale. That's fairly simple. And in the exception that we would have strongly competing phases where they would be very close by, and so in that case we would just take these diverging vertices, make a mean field description of all them all together, and then look what minimizes the free energy. That's sort of what we would do.
This particular graph is a triangular.
That's the triangular lattice, and
what is L on triangular lattice?
It's
120 degrees.
Oh, this is just for, So this was an anisotropic triangular lattice, where I tuned from the square lattice to the triangular lattice. So just for comparison, in the paper I showed that at the triangular point, the vertices that had previously been associated with pi-pi antiferromagnetism don't diverge in the flow, whereas now the 120-degree nail order diverges. That's where this comes from. But so I'm happy to discuss with you all details there. Let's just move on to the actual physics. If you want to have a look at which model you want to see and what the FRG so far has said about this model, I just listed the models that the FRG has been applied to. It started with Johannes Reuter and Peter Wölfle's work when Johannes was still a PhD student in Karlsruhe, and also Wolfram Brenig in the early days worked with Johannes on some topic, and then later on we continued that.
Early days of Wolfram?
Early days of the method. Early days of the method. So let me come to the first topic, the Heisenberg-Kitaev model. And again, I won't waste time again talking about Kitaev-Heisenberg versus Heisenberg-Kitaev. I should have used Kitaev Heisenberg from the start, but in our papers I wasn't aware of that one could possibly think about this being Kitaev Heisenberg, so I just stumbled into that, and now I stick to it because my papers call it Heisenberg Kitaev model. Okay, so you heard a lot in this workshop, so I probably can be fairly brief on this. The main issue here is that that the crystal field in iridium, the spin orbit coupling, and even the interaction scales are sort of comparable. So depending on which approach you take in a perturbative fashion, you either arrive at something that looks like this Heisenberg Kitaev model, so there's a lot of competing perspectives on the same problem because the scales are so comparable. But this is, of course, this pathbreaking work by George, where they took sodium iridate, or no, they made the general argument that certain honeycomb lattice iridium compounds might be nicely described effectively by a Heisenberg term and by a Kitaev term. So let's see what the pseudo-Fermion FRG finds there. So let me just I put the formula in here such that you can still orient yourself what this alpha means. Alpha is this parameter that interpolates from the Heisenberg-only scenario to the Kitaev-only scenario. So when we go to alpha equals 0, this is exactly where the antiferm magnet on the honeycomb lattice should appear. It's a bipartite lattice, so everything is fairly trivial there. And then as you move on with the alpha, you start to evolve into a different type of magnetic ordering, which is the stripy antiferm magnet. And then as soon as you reach the Kitaev limit, you're basically left with only nearest neighbor spin correlations, which manifest in the magnetic susceptibility K resolved as just as a cosine. So this is just a cosine, which just derives from the fact that you have just nearest neighbor interactions there, or nearest neighbor correlations there, that's more precise. Okay, but this is all established work, so I will try to gloss over it a little bit. So the wonderful thing I feel that we can do with this FRG is we can get a glimpse on how we link finite cutoff procedures, how the cutoff flows with the temperature flow. So if you forget temperature for the moment, and here also, and think about that I just plot for you how the vertices evolve as a function of cutoff for the particular orders at hand, and then what you would find is that they look very much like a Curie-Weiss law. You know, that's actually, if I remove these scales, you would think this is actually something that you see in experiment. So when you plot 1 over susceptibility as a function of temperature, then as soon as the order onsets, that's exactly how, it's at least similar how it would look like. And that allowed us to get the first interesting temperature scale of the problem, namely the Curie-Weiss temperature scale, which, for example, Philipp Gegenwart is currently interested in for his more advanced and more complicated problems he's addressing. But then there's the second scale, or that is, again, a plot where I just plotted these extrapolated Curie-Weiss temperatures that we inferred from the cutoff flow on a line. This is just for classical comparison, this is just -3/4 times 5/4 alpha, which would be just the classical expectation of the evolution of the Curie-Weiss temperature as a function of alpha, and you see how the pseudo-Fermion FRG would estimate them. Yeah.
So you seem to identify orders with divergences and stability, right?
Could you say that again?
You identify orders based on divergences and stability. So is there an assumption that transitions are continuous here?
Oh, okay. So the point is that all these methods have an inherent mean field character built into them. So any Merman-Wagner logic does not apply by definition because you discretize the two-particle vertex. So when you just allow for finite frequencies, there's no way that you can see Merman-Wagner physics there.
No, I'm just asking whether you could see if there were first order transition that wouldn't show up in the.
Supposedly not. Supposedly not. Yeah. No. So, for example, stuff like phase separation, I'm not sure whether that would be possible. We we are looking into impurity problems right now, where maybe some similar physics happens. But no, for now, I would say it would be insensitive to first order transitions.
But also, this you know, you don't really have a temperature, right? So this cutoff scale is like an effective temperature. So
it's an effective temperature.
It's not a thermodynamic.
It has no absolute meaning, but
so
to
you don't
our
deal with the free energy. Yes.
Yeah, but to our firm assessment, it has a relative meaning. So if I find two states, if I take a scenario where I tune a Hamiltonian and I find two divergence scales that differ. The trend is certainly that the one that has the higher scale at which it diverges should also have the higher near temperature associated with it. So this relative trends, they're certainly accurate. At least I've never seen any counterexample so far in the last 4 years that I worked with this. Okay, let me come to the second temperature scale. Yeah.
You mentioned this classical. Is it from high temperature?
Yes, exactly. It was just for us to see whether it makes any sense what this FLG gives us from this extrapolation to higher cutoffs. And you see that the corrections are moderate but interesting, as you will see in a second, because that's the first temperature scale that we're interested in. The second one is obviously the critical scale, so at which the ordering happens, and that would be sort of like in the early days how these flows look like. So when this flow becomes unstable, that's actually a recurrent theme in many RG flow equation formulations. An onset of a critical scale can either manifest itself as a divergence or as an instability in the flow evolution. So the flow just becomes unstable and wiggles around. That depends on details of how the differential equation look that you infer from the flow equations. For the FLG here, the point of instability is marked by the point where the smooth flow is stopped and actually it starts wiggling around. So for example, for this alpha equals zero, which was the pure antiferromagnet, you see that it starts to wiggle around at a fairly high cutoff, whereas as we go to higher alpha, the critical point where it starts to wiggle actually moves towards zero.
You have a finite number of sides, correct?
Yes.
So if you increase the number of sides, will you see something, say, better?
The main problem of the discretization artifacts that you have in the method stem from the frequency discretization, and not from the number of sides. We can go to 300, 400 sides. That is so big already that doesn't help. So as we increase from 200 to 300 sides, the change is marginal. But as we increase the frequency discretization, that helps. But as you know, the two-particle vertex has three frequencies. So if we want to double the frequencies, the number of flow equations gets enhanced by a factor of 8. So that's our problem. Our problem is, that's not a problem, but we have a good intuition now how to deal with this finite size features that stem from the frequency discretization. It's not the system size is not a big problem. We can go to 400 sides now, and that has never been a problem. Yeah. Okay, but so this would be the critical scale as we infer it, and you see something interesting. So this critical scale decreases within the Neel antiferromagnet, but funny enough, it stays more or less homogeneous within the stripy antiferromagnet domain, and actually that is not totally inconsistent with experiments by Philipp Gegenwart, where you see that, obviously we can take the frustration parameter and just divide the critical scale against the Curie-Weiss scale. And since the Curie-Weiss scale changes from antiferromagnetic dominant couplings to ferromagnetic ones and gets smaller and smaller, it's very conceivable that as you move from sodium iridate to lithium iridate, the frustration parameter has to go up. So that's, but this is all established work. Let me come to newer things. And you heard about this in this whole workshop, the nature of magnetism in sodium iridate. There was an enormous amount of work in this field, and people concluded experimentally that it should be of zigzag type. Now the question is, how do we reconcile this from theory? Because in the original Heisenberg-Kitaev model, there was an antiferromagnet, there was a stripy phase, and there was a Kitaev phase. So where does the zigzag type phase come from? And there's, again, a lot of theorists in this room contributed to that question. Let me just point out three directions that you might conceive One was reverse the signs in the, in the original Heisenberg-Kitaev model, which was one of George's works, which is telling you, you see, with this careful perturbative analysis that George has George and Gignard have done in 2009, 2010, the fact that these all these scales are so comparable makes it extremely hard to pinpoint what is the right parameter regime. So in within a completely consistent way, you either arrive at some Heisenberg-Kitaev Hamiltonian that has positive sign for the Heisenberg term and negative sign for the Kitaev term, but then you can also just tweak minor things in your perturbative approach to the problem, in the multi-orbital perturbative approach to the problem, and arrive at sort of, if you wish, the antipodal Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's one direction. The other direction is to think about the relevance of second nearest neighbor Kitaev coupling, which we did particularly in the context of sodium of lithium iridate. But then also Natasha told you in her nice work on the K1, K2 model how relevant the next nearest neighbor Kitaev coupling can be and what type of interesting new exotic physics it can give rise to. Well, the third option that I want to elaborate a little bit on, which we first thought about in 2012 together with Philip and Simon, was the role of longer-range Heisenberg couplings. So, but let me be brief on this. It's obvious that in this longer-range Heisenberg models, you get the zigzag phase for large J2 and large J3. So we did, in another work with Dima Abanin, we looked at the phase diagram for the J1, J2, J3 honeycomb model. And of course, we reproduced that there's the zigzag phase. And then, of course, the question was, as we add longer-range Heisenberg terms to the Heisenberg-Kitaev model, can we reach that zigzag phase, and does it have any relevance to experiment? I think the question is still very unclear, I would say. At least it would be a consistent proposal to think about longer-range Heisenberg couplings, but there are so many terms on the market now. There's the gamma term, there's the longer-range Kitaev terms, there's longer-range Heisenberg terms. So I think, let me summarize that topic by saying which elementary low-energy spin model we will eventually arrive at is far from trivial, and it will need further theoretical investigation what the actual low-energy description will be. Okay, let me come to the second part of the talk. Namely, I want to look into topological insulating band structures and just assume for the moment that we can crank up some Hubbard coupling and look into the strong coupling limit of these topological band structures. And Which other problem should we start with but the famous Kane-Mealy model? So I'd call it minimal Kane-Mealy model because I get rid of Rushbaugh spin orbit coupling. I only look into nearest neighbor hopping on the honeycomb lattice plus the U1 conserving, some people call it intrinsic spin orbit coupling, plus some Hubbard interaction U. So that's the Hamiltonian. And that's just a sketch of how the Hamiltonian eventually looks like. You can do this with some cluster methods and so on. I won't get into detail. But of course, I'm sure a lot of people in the audience are aware of the story that this phase diagram witnessed in the last years. So starting from a spin liquid phase here, which turned out to be not there, and other aspects. So people got very interested in this phase diagram. But I think, funny enough, in the end of the day, it looks fairly boring, I would say. So all there is there's a semi-metal, then there's a Gros-Neveu transition to the antiferro magnet, and there's just some persisting topological insulating regime before the system eventually becomes magnetic. Let's still, as a warm-up, try to reconcile how we understand what type of magnetic phase this band structure should give you as soon as you crank up U, okay? It's a 10-minute problem. So the spin Hamiltonian looks like this. So obviously, from this hopping, you just get the standard Heisenberg coupling. And then you get another spin exchange coupling from the spin orbit term, which now breaks spin rotation symmetry. And it applies to the next nearest neighbor terms, and it looks ferromagnetic in the XY plane and antiferromagnetic in the z-axis. And just looking at this Hamiltonian, anyone can more or less immediately say what this magnetic order should be. If this term wants to drive antiferromagnetic order on this bipartite honeycomb lattice, then it wants the attractive coupling on the second nearest neighbor. So this will not at all frustrate the magnet, as long as the magnet chooses any axis in the xy plane, but it will certainly favor the xy plane because it would be frustrated in the z axis. But since the magnetic order, the magnetic vector has all three coordinates to play with, it will just choose to polarize in the xy plane. So that's why the conclusion is very simple. You should get an xy-oriented antiferromagnet. And that's exactly what you get, and that's also what we see with FRG. These are just, again, these magnetic susceptibility plots that you already got slightly accustomed to. And once I look at the susceptibility in x-direction, representative for the xy-plane, and then I look at the susceptibility in z-direction. And just look at the absolute scales. It looks a bit messy here, but just the response is just super, it gets much, much smaller as j lambda is cranked up. So that's actually all there is about the Kane-Mealy-Hubbard model. And, well, let's move on to some other problem that might be more interesting. And there was, to my assessment, a fantastic paper by Schietade et al. On thinking about other ways spin orbital coupling can appear in these band structures. So this is a particular spin orbital coupling where you have, it's again, second nearest neighbor. But then, depending on the bond, it either comes along with a sigma y matrix, a sigma z matrix, or a sigma x matrix. Okay. So no Kitaev yet, but you'll see it, of course, here. Okay, so this type of spin orbital coupling has been discussed in the weak interaction regime in the Schietade et al. Paper. But then let's have a look how the spin Hamiltonian looks when we send u to infinity, and just in the strong coupling expansion, it looks more interesting than the Kane-Mealy model. You just have the Heisenberg term. Obviously, you can't avoid it as a matter of principle, by the way. I mean, that's my... Actually, there was a question in Jeroen's talk. Can you have a band structure for which you... can you have a Hubbard model for which you get the Kitaev model? Well, I think it's not that trivial to get a band structure where you only get the Kitaev term. There was one paper by Hassan and Seneschal, but that breaks certain symmetries that you don't want to break. Anyways, let me just leave that comment aside. But so you have here, what you have here is a Heisenberg term. Then you get another attractive next nearest neighbor Heisenberg term from the spin orbit coupling. But then in addition, you have these Kitaev type interactions that now, and let me denote the notation, this gamma is just along the next nearest neighbor bonds. And this is exactly the Kitaev term, now realized not nearest neighbor, as in George's model, but realized along second nearest neighbor. Okay. And let's see what this model. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, finish your sentence.
No, please.
So I was thinking, but George's model is also a Hubbard model. It's a three-band Hubbard model, right?
Yeah, but you always have a Heisenberg term. You can't.
Not necessarily.
Really? Okay, so then I have to look into this.
It depends on the parameters. So you could say there is a...
But it would be an extremely fine-tuned scenario, no? I mean, I would say. But okay, so how do you want to avoid this thing? I mean, this is really hard. You have to really look here. I mean, you really have to compensate. On nearest neighbor, you have to compensate for a Heisenberg term that just standardly derives to leading order in a strong coupling expansion.
Yeah, so you might be able. The fantastic thing is that in the era days, this interferes.
Yeah, I agree with you. No, I totally agree with you.
Disappears. Magic. And
all I'm saying is that it's very hard to single out one of these terms generically in a non-fine-tuned fashion. I think that is not as easy for very generic reasons, because they, of course, come along with each other. Okay, but let me go back here. So what we have here is a Kitaev term on the triangular lattice, effectively, because we are talking about second nearest neighbor couplings on the honeycomb lattice. So there has been a work by Greg Feet on this, and they did some slave rotor approach. Forget about this. This is just an artifact of the slave rotor approach. It's an antiferromagnet. But they were talking about the quantum spin Hall they were talking about an interesting fractionalized version of the quantum spin-Hall state, which maybe by now we would call fractional quantum spin-Hall state, but at that time, I think wisely, Greg chose to use a new word, so it was quantum spin-Hall star phase. But let's leave that aside and let's look at the spin Hamiltonian as is, which is what we can do with this FRG. So again, there's this coupling J1, and in units of J1, so if I say J, you see, in units of J1, we just crank up J gamma tilde. And as we do this for a long time, nothing happens. Like this, basically nothing happens there. But then at some stage, these peaks, reminiscent of the magnetic bipartite antiferromagnetic order, start to move. And they move inside, and at the same, as they move inside, two other peaks appear. And as if we were actually to crank up J gamma to infinity, these peaks would actually become as big as the others. So what is this? And that we could understand fairly accurately. This is essentially saying that there's an antiferromagnet to spiral transition. And we could precisely trace back what the nature of this spiral transition is. We could also look at how the spiral peaks evolve in the magnetic Brillouin zone as a function of this parameter, which if it were ever realized in experiment would be nice, because then this precisely parameterizes how far you are away from the antiferromagnetic transition and where you should be in this parameter regime of J lambda twiddle. If we send J lambda twiddle to infinity, then forget about this Heisenberg term and all you're left with is spin exchange terms acting on the triangular lattice, right? And then when this goes, and when this is the case, you can use a Klein duality rotation that George pioneered for the alpha equal to 0.5 scenario in the Heisenberg-Kitaev model to actually map the problem onto a magnetic model that you would know how to solve, and then you rotate back whatever order you find there, and you get a new type of order in this range. I won't talk too much about this here. Let me just mention that lately we have also generalized this Klein duality to Hubbard models, and I can't talk about this here, but in case you're interested, I'm happy to address that during these workshops weeks that are still to come. Okay, but let's come back here. So what we find here is that there was an antiferromagnet to spiral transition, and now comes the interesting point. We wanted to connect to Greg Feith's work from 2011. And we wanted to see within Greg's approach, where should we see the nail to spiral transition? And that's what I tried to sketch by saying, let's extend u to infinity, which is the point that we can track. And funny enough, the extrapolated phase boundary from Greg exactly merges with the phase transition that we find from the nail to spiral transition. Okay, you see what I'm saying? So there's the Hubbard model, and Greg Feith was interested in looking into this Hubbard model here, but then our results very nicely match with him in the sense that as we take the u to infinity limit within his description, the phase boundary between the antiferromagnet to whatever there is actually matches perfectly. And let me just conclude by saying, as soon as u1 conserving spin-orbit coupling is complemented by U1 breaking spin-orbit coupling, such as Rochebach, then I think the possible realm of interesting states in interacting topological insulators is much bigger than before. That's just the takeaway message.
No, it's not in like kind of fine-tuning. Well, these are two different models using two different approaches. And the result...
I don't want to pose too much emphasis on this. I'm just saying it's nicely consistent, that's it. The last sentence that I made is more fundamental, I believe. I'm saying that if I take intrinsic spin-orbit coupling that conserves U1, and I take the infinite U limit of whatever band structure you like, my contention is that this model might not be as interesting as it comes to unconventional avenues of frustrated magnetism or even more exotic stuff, as a system where you have Rochebach spin orbit coupling from the start. Because the Rochebach spin orbit coupling immediately breaks the full SU2 symmetry, and well, maybe modulo Z2, but it breaks any continuous remainder symmetry there is in the spin model. And just generically, I believe that is probably the more promising path to look into interesting frustrated magnetic phenomena stemming from topological band structures. That's the
stuff. Well, to have rush power, you have to break the inversion.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, but this is generically done. I mean, look at all these heterostructures. As Fun talked about, where's Fun? As Fun talked about it. So actually, getting a large Rushbar term might be much simpler than getting a large intrinsic spin orbit term, because you can just tune it with electric field, right? So I think I think it's you can substantiate the comment. Okay. So let me come within the last 5 to 10 minutes. Yeah, but I counted. I mean, this counts. This thing. It says I spoke for 49 minutes. Well, this presenter slide, you know, in Keynote, it tells me how long. It says 50 minutes. I've wasted already. But you know, but let me be brief. But I want to talk about this. Anytime I come to Santa Barbara, I want to talk about this, and I never have time. So I just take five minutes on this. So chiral spin liquids. The fractionalization of spin to many in the audience is fairly is an established thing. Let me just mention shortly what I mean by that. Some of you might know the IKLT chain, which is the spin one chain, where you get at the boundary, you just get spin one half particles. That is very much like the Kitaev wire. In the Kitaev wire, your constituent objects are electrons. They fractionalize to give rise to half an electron at each boundary. So when you take a spin one chain, you have similar physics there. It fractionalizes and gives rise to half a spin one, namely a spin half on the left and one on the right boundary. Okay, but there's another notion of fractionalization of spin that you can most easily appreciate in the context of the chiral spin liquid as soon as you've ever seen any Laughlin wave function. So let's assume that I built a spin state by saying that I act with spin flip operators on a downspin polarized vacuum, and I parameterize the positions of these spin flip particles now. I talk about spin flip particles by the positions z1 to zn. So if I have n sites and I want to have a singlet state, then I need half as many spin flip particles as I have sites. So I'm at spin flip particle filling 1/2. Okay, very easy. So then let's have a look at this wave function. Like, each of these configurations comes along with a wave function weight that then depends on the positions of the spin flip particles. And let's look how the chiral spin liquid looks. The chiral spin liquid modulo some normalization terms that are unimportant. It looks like a Jastrow factor squared. And the Jastrow factor squared is just simply the bosonic Laughlin state at filling 1/2. So this chiral spin liquid is just a Laughlin state at filling 1/2, where the constituent particles are not electrons anymore, but spin flips. Now, how does fractional quantum numbers come along in this notation? So let's have a look at the elementary spin 1/2 excitation in a chiral spin liquid, which actually looks just like the quasi-hole excitation of the Laughlin state. So as you would know in the logic of the Laughlin state, you would say, okay, the electrons screen each other in such a way that the wave function decays by a certain power. In that case, we can't think about electrons because we have a bosonic wave function, but let's say some bosons, they screen each other to second power, but then you see that this power here is just the first power. So whatever this excitation is that lives on site eta, it only manages to screen away the other spin flip particles half as well as the spin flip particles are away to screen each other. So obviously, it should have half the charge. And what is the charge in that case? In that case, this is not charged from E to E over 2, which would be the case for the bosonic Laughlin state, but it is spin 1 to spin 1/2, because the different particles here carry spin 1, because spin flip particles carry spin 1. So this is just another manifestation of fractionalized quantum numbers. Okay, so this chiral spin liquid, and why am I trying to emphasize this so much? So when this fractional churn insulator field emerged in 2009, I think a lot of people just didn't seem to appreciate that this has existed since 87, because the chiral spin liquid is nothing else but a bosonic fractional churn insulator. I mean, when you talk about a quantum Hall system, you put it on a lattice. This is exactly what you accomplish through a chiral spin liquid, which Karl Mayer and Laughlin thought about already by 87. And a lot of work went into this field in the late 80s, when anion superconductivity was still hip and not disproven experimentally. Okay, and as you go through the list of interesting features, and I don't have time, obviously, and I don't want to waste your time, and you need to go to lunch, you can also see what type of people actually worked on this field in that time. I mean, these were the sort of top-notch, high-energy people that also entered that field, such as Frank Wilczek or Tony Z. A lot of things were known about the chiral-spin liquid that, to my assessment, sort of have been reinvented in the fractional churn insulator community. I mean, for example, that the chiral-spin liquid can be defined on any lattice, as was shown by Benoit Dussault and Sriram Shastri, actually gives you a very strong intuition about why there are so many different lattices where fractional churn insulators can appear. The quantum Hall fluid can materialize on any lattice. Okay, it doesn't really care about the lattice, so it's minor microscopic details then that you have to adjust. But it's totally natural to assume that the fractional churn insulator should stabilize on many different lattices. Okay, but let me just leave that aside and come to the main problem of this field. The fractional churn insulators, they have the big plus that their Hamiltonians were tractable immediately with numerics, and everyone could see that they can actually be stabilized on their computers. And that was not the case in 87. I think that was the main drawback. And then the alternative would have been, can we find a microscopic model? Can we find an exact model for this problem? And that, again, unfortunately took longer than needed for the field to really stay alive. And it was in 2007, we found the first exact Hamiltonian for the chiral-spin liquid model. So this is how it would look in your on your computer. So this is just the high symmetry points in your finite size periodic boundary condition system. And you would get two ground states at the gamma point. They are exactly degenerate. And you can look at them, and they are actually exactly, they show the topological degeneracy as you put the chiral-spin liquid wave function on the torus, where you replace the Jastrow factors by Jacobi theta functions, and you get center of mass degeneracy. Okay, but then I really enjoyed to see that this field really revived in the last years. So in 2012, we sort of thought about a better way to get an exact Hamiltonian for the chiral-spin liquid, and essentially, and this is just, I just copy-pasted it from our paper, but essentially it involves just the chirality term and some Heisenberg terms. And then in 2012, the same Hamiltonian was derived by, totally independently, by Ignacio Sirac and Anne Nielsen and company. And then in 2013, I think the posting, 2D DMRG was employed to the Kagome lattice by just taking the chirality operator, put it on the Kagome lattice, and look whether you find the chiral spin liquid, and they did. And since then, this field has really grown again and was revitalized. Let me just mention that maybe there's yet another field that would be interesting to revitalize, namely the generalization of chiral spin liquids to parafermionic or Mu-Reed and Reed-Rezai type spin liquids. In 2009, we wrote down a series of the Reed-Rezai generalization of chiral spin liquids, where higher spin lattices are needed to realize the given spin model. But I also have microscopic Hamiltonians in that paper, so I'm currently discussing with 2D DMRG people how to realize that, how to put that on the computer and actually get meaningful results there. So I just wanted to stress that this chiral spin liquid, to stay in this analogy, is just the abelian Laughlin state that actually easily allows you to access this other interesting field of contemporary condensed matter physics, namely non-abelian excitations and topological quantum computation, at least alongside as a vision, where we can actually manage to get even Reed-Rezai type spin and excitations. So parafermionic spin and excitations. Okay. Yeah. So then just to show you some works by Yin Chen He. He was lately quite interested in that, and a recent numerical development was that SU2 symmetry-breaking spin Hamiltonians might be important to stabilize chiral spin liquids. And that's where I want to connect to this workshop, because SU2 braking spin Hamiltonians can most easily be accomplished by having some spin orbit coupling in the band structure from where the strong coupling Hamiltonian arrives. So I'm just putting this out there here, saying that maybe spin orbit induced anisotropic spin attractions can help to stabilize a Karaspin liquid. And that I don't have time anymore. There's to my assessment, a very elegant way to think about Karaspin liquids only deriving from anisotropic spin-spin interactions. I don't need anything else but this. I just need spin-spin interactions to accomplish the Karaspin liquid, and that we've done in a coupled wire construction. But I don't have time anymore, and instead, let me thank you for your attention. By the way, it says 59 and 46 seconds.
Well, 1 hour, you could say discussion.
Okay. But there were discussions when the...
Okay, so we have 1 minute left for discussion.
I would like to come back to the effort. The very starting point, I mean, this pseudo-fermion, or like people nowadays like to call it parton, description of a spin, usually leads to people constructing on a mean field level Fermi surfaces for a large variety of spin systems. Now, if you look into the FRG, the propagator for the fermion is local.
Yeah.
It does have an imaginary part. And so I wonder if there is any way to reconcile this one world where people construct kind of Fermi surfaces and whatever interesting spin liquids from this parton description, and the FRG, which somehow seems to have a propagator, which at least is hard to understand how it should ever come up with a Fermi surface.
It's a complicated and important question, but the short answer is the way it's formulated, we intentionally do not allow this propagator to become non-local.
Right.
So the way the flow equations are written down, it stays local and it will always stay local.
So you would never get a spin liquid in that sense.
So there's these super exotic spin liquids where they have the spin on Fermi surfaces and everything. Okay. So within that regime of spin liquids, the degree of sophistication you need to employ to even get it at a mean field level is very high. And I think that's by far the last state. That's the last state I would try to model with such a flow equation approach. I think it's nearly impossible to arrive at such a state in a controlled RG fashion.
Would you say it is not possible?
Formally it is possible. It is possible by just allowing more coupling constants, right? So we can just say, we would have to allow for these fluctuations that then would demand us to include non-local terms in the Green's function. So, I can just tell you from all I understand about this field, beside mean field theory and getting some band structures from mean field theory and doing some spectroscopy with this, nothing has happened. There's no way to connect this to any microscopic model. I mean, the best people have worked on this for years, Patrick Lee and company. There's so many interesting papers on that, but I would say the step to connect any microscopic model that you define as the starting point of whatever flow equation you come up with this type of low energy description, I think is very complicated. And it has not been accomplished, nearly.
So, Ronnie, you simply want to say that there's no microscopic model where you have a spin on Fermi surface?
Well,
because that's simply not true.
Well,
you know that.
So I know what you work on, Maria, and I know your papers, and I know there can be there are generalizations of the Gitaev model where, depending on the lattice you choose, you can have an exactly solvable model in which you can have spin on Fermi surfaces. I completely agree with this. I am saying that for the generic, preferably two-dimensional scenarios that people looked into, be it in the context of this Yashima et al. Experiments, on the BEDT compounds, be it for any other kinds of organics where people started talking about these ideas. It is very complicated to transcend from any mean field treatment to a generic emergence of such physics. Now, you can say, here you don't need mean field treatment, but I would say you need a super fine-tuned, extremely exotic model to get it. That's my point. So you see, you trade one thing versus the other. That's fantastic work. I'm simply trying to answer Wolfram Breenig's question in saying, having the joint emergence of a generic microscopic model that then, by whatever formulation, leads to such a phase in a fairly controlled fashion has been elusive so far. And I think that statement is accurate.
You can have a Fermi-9, and it has been constructed in 2D.
But look at the constructions. I mean, it's fairly contrived.
In order.
So in your models of the chiral spin liquid, by exact, do you mean exactly solvable, or what do you mean by exact?
By exact, I mean that the ground state is exactly the Laughlin wave function.
Okay.
That I mean by exact. And I also mean by exact that whereas in the generic topologically ordered domains, you would have a finite size splitting between the different ground states, within that model, by construction, as it has exactly the Laughlin state as a ground state, you get this topological degeneracy exact even for a finite size system. But of course, that is no problem. I mean, if you spoiled this a little bit, then as you know, the splitting between the topological ground states vanishes exponentially as system size. So you shouldn't worry too much about that part of the story. But I'm saying it's exact in the sense that the Karlmeier-Laughlin state is the precise ground state and unique ground state up to topological degeneracy.
Yeah.
So
Fred was first.
No, actually, I'm. You mentioned in the last slide you have this, capital wire construction for the chiral spin liquid, right? That's certainly very interesting. So can I understand in the following way? So people have this capital wire construction for any type of fractional quantum Hall states.
Yeah.
And people also have this, mapping between chiral spin liquid and some fractional quantum Hall states. So in that sense, it's possible to have a couple wire construction for this kind of
fun. I know that you work a lot with Charlie. Okay, so in the Theo Kane paper, they arrive at a Luttinger Hamiltonian with three non-commuting cosine terms. You know this. They eventually arrive at this, and they refermionize two to infer that they have the Riedel-Zeiss series stabilized. We get precisely the same Hamiltonian in the Luttinger liquid description, but now the elementary degrees of freedom were spin modes that we get from taking the wires, imposing the mod gaps, and then just tuning spin-spin interactions between the wires to get that state. So my answer is this immediate identity between the wave function descriptions in first quantization completely carries over to the coupled wire construction in, if you wish, field theory language.
Yeah, so maybe I can comment on this spin on Fermi surface.
Yeah.
I think you are right. So the connection from a microscopic spin model to a U1 spin liquid with spin on Fermi surface is elusive. And what she was talking about is a Z2 spin liquid. And Z2 spin, the gauge factor is very weak. So you can ignore gauge
factor. Yeah, I agree.
That's a Kitai model. No, that's so exactly. That's what
towards that direction is definitely a very important step. And I completely agree that if there's ever to be found such a state in experiment, I think the first one would be the Z2 one, and certainly not the U1.
Could be.
Yeah, I would. Yeah. At least the theoretical comments would be way more substantiated for the Z2 case than for the U1.
It seems that most existing quantum spin liquids are critical spin liquids with gapless modes. Anyway.
Yeah.
I just have a question on this chiral spin liquid model. So
which one?
Just any.
Okay.
So the model you wrote down, does it explicitly break time model symmetry?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
So one question is, how important is the lattice? Suppose I destroy the lattice, can this state can be smoothly connected to the continuum limit? You get a Landau level, partial field of the Landau level. you get a lot of the entire state. Is this mostly connected to that state?
There are some
how important well, that is?
The way you pose your question, there's a lot of subtleties in answering it, and I won't go into all of them, but I will go into one aspect of it. The exact Hamiltonians that we wrote down work for any lattice. You choose any lattice you like. You will always find the Karo-Spin liquid to be the exact ground state. And that statement is super old. This is from Benoit Dussault from 1988. He realized that all along, this paper in 88. He realized that he's a quantum Hall fluid. It can materialize on any lattice that you allow it to materialize. You can think of a lattice, and you can think of just this fluid to be there, and then it's just you throw in the lattice points as you like. It doesn't care about it. It will
sure, always. Sure. That's smoothly connected. You know, there is a notion called symmetry enrichment, symmetry enriched topological order.
Yeah.
So you can have you can emerge new phases which cannot be smoothly connected to certain.
I totally agree. That's these SET phases and fun. We have another paper on these coupled wire constructions. It's called wire deconstructionism of topological phases, in which we exactly look for the type of fractionalized phases that you mentioned, Gunn. So there are cases in which you have topological order in terms of topological ground state degeneracy that demands a certain symmetry to fortify it. Well, it will sustain weak breaking of that symmetry because it has a phase stiffness. So any long-range entangled phase will not just be killed just by you tiny breaking any symmetry. But So answer is yes, you can even use the wire construction to get also these
benefits.
Thanks. Yeah, I think we can close
this
session here. It's only that he's here for another 2 weeks, and you can ask him questions and discuss. And it's probably good time to go for lunch. Thank you.